You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. And 1 o'clock at this time, it's the live today here on Thanksgiving Day with Don Olson and Dave Gudnick. And we're going to be dealing with something which is at the top of the news, print, radio, television, and they're all trying to create or undermine the narrative that Dave and I try and present something alternative to how you understand what the history of what's been going on in the Russia-Ukraine. Dave, you want to start off?
Yeah, thanks, Don. I want to say it was very moving to listen to Leonard Peltier and his daughter, and he reminded us how important the history is to him and the treatment of his people and the native peoples kept him going. And that's part of what keeps me going, too, because I don't really think you can understand what's happening in Ukraine or the current kerfuffle around negotiations without knowing some of the history. And Americans are notoriously amnesiac. And this is why Don and I and others keep harping on at least the last 30 years, because that's how long this campaign against Russia in Ukraine has been going on, actually longer than that. But the point is, you can't understand the present without a bit of understanding of the past. I want to mention, too, with thanks to Ed Feline, now retiring, Southside Pride publisher and editor, one final edition in December. We'll have another column by me about the background to the war and also about propaganda, because that's a big, big part of their ability to pursue these kind of campaigns. So I had a prior column in there about Russophobia, which has very deep historical roots. So thanks again to Ed Feline, and I'll be making some of the same points today that are in my final column called History Lessons.
Good. We're going to start off today with Ray McGovern, who's a former CIA analyst, and he was on Judging Freedom with Judge Napolitano, and that was from Monday. Not too many minutes, but and then we'll talk about it after that.
One more bit, just to emphasize the context, because Ray gets into a number of specifics about the current situation, but it's important to understand that the fundamental root cause in the eyes of the Russians and many of us is NATO expansion, which is a decades-long project. And neutrality of Ukraine was overthrown, was in their 1991 constitution until the coup of 2014. And that is the probably necessary solution, neutrality for Ukraine, no NATO.
Come here, my dear friend. I want to dive deeply into the 28-point plan. I don't know if it's a subterfuge to keep people's eyes off of the Israelis attacking Lebanon and the United States about to attack Venezuela. We'll get to that eventually. But do we know the origins of the 28-point plan? I mean, who speaks for Russia? Who speaks for the United States? Is it these two billionaire buddies of Trump and Putin?
No, Putin's personal representative in the person of Kirill Dmitriev flew off to Florida to talk with Steve Witkoff for 3 days at the end of October. Therein lies the solution. We know from pretty reliable sources that Ukrainian National Security Council Chief Umerov was also there for a while. So they whittled this thing together in a kind of a talking points sort of way. It's just, you know, parts of it are self-contradictory, inconsistent, and it's very, very unfinished. But the big thing is that Trump is making a big thing of it, and Putin is playing along. Now, let me introduce a extraneous factor here. First of all, I agree with those, including Alistair, who say that in mid-October, Trump finally realized that he had been diddled, that he had been led down the Gordon path by the likes of Kellogg and perhaps Rubio and other hardliners within the White House and the State Department. So mid-October is big. After that came not only the collapse of Ukrainian forces on the front line, but also the raising of corruption charges. Very convenient to get Zelensky a little bit scared. Here's my chronology. Here's the extraneous factor. When do the nominations for the Nobel Peace Prize begin for 2026? It says, mid-October. Well, let's say that's October 15th. So I did a little chronology here. Oh, well, Kate, October 15th, what happened on the 16th? Oh, well, Trump announced that we're going to have another summit. It'll be at Budapest, and we're going to get to a final solution to the Korean crisis at the 16th. Okay, 17th. Zelensky comes to the White House, and Trump says, no, but think about those missiles, those missiles that you've been trying to get. We're not going to give them to you, the 17th, okay? Whoa. That was a big backlash, okay? So Trump had to do a little dancing and took a lot of flack. So what do we have on the 22nd? We have the imposition of really tough sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil, the two big Russian oil companies. Okay, that's the 22nd. But the Russians like to say, I've not got it. But what happens on the 23rd, the day after the imposition of these terrible sanctions, which even Scott Bessent doesn't place any store by, but that's another thing. What happened on the next day? Oh, Kirill Dmitriev is sent by Putin to Florida to talk to Witkoff, to talk to Umerov when he shows up, and they chisel this thing together. It's more the nature of talking points. The big deal is that Putin said, well, yeah, let's consider that. That could be a basis for the final settlement. That's really interesting. So what do I see here? I see that Trump, I mean, I blanch when I hear myself say this. He's partially motivated by wanting to have a Nobel Peace Prize. And if he gets maybe something going by Thanksgiving and maybe even enough going for a ceasefire by Christmas, oh my God, that's, well, the nominations close on January 31st. Okay, now, people might think that's a little ridiculous. 2 months ago, I would have thought so. But look at what Trump has said about the Nobel Peace Prize. So I think what Trump is doing here is giving the Europeans getting them out of the flow of things. Europeans are very scared, but they're powerless. And that's where I differ with many of my colleagues. The Europeans have no troops, they have no money, they have no leverage, okay? The leverage is not with the Europeans. So what leverage does Trump have? Well, not much, but I think Trump understands that Putin would rather have a negotiated settlement of some kind based on current realities. So he's playing on that. That's very, very little leverage. And you could see that in the points that are being discussed. You could see that in Trump saying today, this morning, oh, wow, this is going to be great. We're well on our way. What did he exactly say? Oh, yeah, it's time for Europe to go it alone. Well, that's what the Guardian is saying. Here's Trump. Big progress is being made in the peace negotiations between Ukraine and Russia. And, of course, we have Rubio and even Kellogg singing the same song over the weekend. So what do I foresee? I see some real negotiations. Russia's not going to give up much because it doesn't have to.
Right.
Is adopting this nonchalant, dismissive attitude. Okay, we like negotiations. We're always open for that. But, you know, we just assume go ahead and finish the damn thing off with a special military operations.
Take take a listen to President Putin, Zelensky. President Zelensky, a gloomy President Zelensky yesterday, who pretty much is saying, look, I have to choose between the indignity of giving up all this land that I believe is part of Ukraine, and the loss of my most valuable partner, the United States. Chris, cut number three.
Зараз один з найважчих моментів нашої історії.
This is one of the most difficult moments in our history. The pressure on Ukraine is now at its most intense. Ukraine may now face a very difficult choice, either the loss of dignity, or the risk of losing a key partner, or 28 difficult points, or an extremely harsh winter. The most difficult and further risk are life without freedom, without dignity, without justice, and believing someone who has already attacked us twice.
And believing someone who has already attacked us twice. I guess he's forgotten about Minsk 1 and Minsk 2 and that subterfuge. Why would Putin trust any negotiation that the Europeans participated in? He wouldn't,
and that's why they're excluded. Why Trump has ruled them out. Now, the Europeans are described as being really enraged at this. But they have no leverage. So they said before, they have no money, they have no arms, they have nothing without the United States. That's the all-encompassing reality for me.
What do you think Zelensky will do? Doesn't he risk not only the loss of his presidency, but maybe the loss of his life? So if he concedes to this?
I think it's really a case of Zelensky will stay there as long as the U.S. and Britain think he can be useful. There's no real outside person that can take his place right now. Part of these 28 points are elections in Ukraine, and ipso facto, Zelensky would be out. So I see the U.S. and Britain and the others, U.S. at least, saying, look, Zelensky can hang around as long as he does what he's told. Now, as I say before.
So that's Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, speaking there with Judge Napolitano on the judging freedom. That was on Monday.
Some important points that were made and should have been mentioned. That these are talking points. It's not a peace plan, and the disagreements embedded in them are very deep. Europeans can't agree, the Ukrainians can't agree, the U.S. can't agree, and the Russians can't agree, so they can agree on something. But there's a lot of deep problems with these points, so I hesitate to even call it a peace plan.
I have to know what he's told. Now, if he finds that...
It's not a peace plan. It's a set of talking points, and there's a lot of important things to say about it, both positive and negative. Meanwhile, what we got a bunch of business cronies and novices trying to play diplomacy, and the Russians, meanwhile, are saying they have yet to even see any official communication about this thing at all. So, again, you got to remember that this is another bumbling, stumbling step toward recognizing that Ukraine is losing the war, and we have to do something. So, again, it's a long ways away. And there was a mention there of Minsk, and why would Putin trust the United States? There's a widespread false meme going around that Russia doesn't want to negotiate, and they've been trying to discuss mutual security concerns, the fundamental issue again with NATO and the whole European security arrangement, and they have been denied and ignored and dismissed over and over in 2007, in 2014-15, in 2022, and since then. So, and U.S., meanwhile, has withdrawn from nuclear treaties, and the Minsk 2014-15 agreement was admittedly used by the West to arm Ukraine and prepare for more war. So this is the context for the question, why would Putin trust the word of the U.S.? So this is another snag in the whole problem. Again, the root causes are the U.S. drive for global dominance and carried out through NATO, among other means. And this has been going on since the 90s. Lots of people warned against it. Diplomats, military people, scholars, and more.
What the media tries to convince you of. And this was in a New York Times article in today's Star Tribune reprinted it. A quote from Tatiana Stanovaya, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Russian Eurasian Center. The essence of this war is to weaken the Ukraine. Ukraine itself is in an ever-deepening crisis, and sooner or later they'll break. Putin knows that clearly, and that's all. He doesn't need to know anything else. Well, that's how the New York Times and everybody else is trying to get people to think that is that this is how it's been, whereas the U.S. Department of Defense, Lloyd Austin, said the point of the war was to weaken Russia. And that's actually how it's always been going on for all these decades.
NATO's Stoltenberg made this same statement, and a number of times this has been repeated as the point of the war. They don't like to emphasize it, but they've admitted it many times, and they put the imposed, beginning 2014, the most extreme economic sanctions ever seen against a country. And it's all according to a plan hatched in the 1990s, where global dominance by the U.S. was the strategy and the aim, and no peer power would be allowed. So this means that there was a drive beginning in the 1990s. Brzezinski, the famous empire theorist, in his 1997 book, The Grand Chessboard, identified Ukraine as the key to this strategy. Without it, Russia was weak. With Ukraine, Russia was strong. And I'm just giving you these things to remind you that this strategy and this war on Russia goes back a few decades at the least. It stepped up to another escalated level in 2014, and at that point, U.S. and Western intelligence took over and rebuilt from the ground up Ukrainian intelligence. U.S. military took over the command of the war, as detailed in March of this year by a thousands of word New York Times article. And we established CIA bases, took over their biowarfare labs. So this became a U.S. and Western NATO war. Ukraine lost its agency with that coup, lost its democratically elected government, Yanukovych, who is trying to trade in both directions.
Now, you mentioned bio labs. Now, that's something is not talked about for a long time, but nobody will believe that.
Admitted in Congress by Victoria Nuland, the war witch herself, that yes, of course, we only did it for scientific or defensive preventive reasons, but she said so. It's online.
Yes, and so these were overrun relatively early in when the Russia had their special operation procedure where they invaded into the Ukraine, but every single commentator, corporate and public, never talk about the Istanbul Agreement at the 1 month later, after Russia went in February 22nd, 24th, 2022, just at the end of March, beginning of April, there was an agreement signed, and between Russia, the Ukraine, there was observers. The shape of Ukraine would go back to its original shape. There would be the Russian language and culture would be respected in the eastern part of the Ukraine, the Donbas. And the and there would be nothing. There would be neutrality for the Ukraine.
I want to point out to listeners a couple of key examples of how the propaganda works and key concepts. And one of them is around a ceasefire. Why can't we just call a ceasefire? And Russia doesn't want to do that because it ignores the root causes of the war. As I was mentioning before, the key issues are mutual security on some kind of regional basis. And so they over and over you hear ceasefire, ceasefire, but it's only one time did Trump, after meeting with Trump, with Putin in Alaska, he gained clarity. One time he said, "I no longer argue for a ceasefire in place because that will break down without a comprehensive security agreement." This is the one time you've heard from our high official the reason why a simple ceasefire in place will not work. And I want to talk about another key concept, which is unprovoked. You've all heard 1,000 times that this war and invasion by Russia was unprovoked, and yet it was provoked and planned for years. I've indicated some of that. After that 2014 coup, the overthrow of the democratically elected government and the trashing of the neutrality in the Constitution, the parliament proceeded quickly to prohibit the Russian language, which was actually the majority language in Ukraine, and they discriminated against opposition politicians, killed one or two of them. They started discriminating against the Russian Eastern Orthodox Church, all as part of this campaign, which led up to bombardment of their fellow Ukrainian citizens in the Eastern Donbass Oblast for 8 years, killing at least 14,000, mostly civilians, bombarding their fellow Ukrainians, at which point those oblast population were, as you can imagine, pretty frustrated and decided to declare their independence. A procedure, by the way, upheld for Kosovo in Serbia area, so we would have to respect it for the Donbass oblast to declare their independence as well. Went against the notion of keeping Ukraine intact, which is why at first Putin didn't approve of it. But the threat of greater attacks with a big buildup of Ukrainian troops outside the Donbass area and increasing bombardment by a factor of 5 or 10 in early February led Russia to say, okay, we've got to step in. Now, this intervention was successful in the eyes of the West because it was provoked. That was the aim. The aim was war, wider war in Ukraine to try to weaken Russia. So it was provoked and planned for years. And when Russia finally intervened, the war planners regarded this as a success because they wanted to drain Russia through war.
So Istanbul conference that I was talking about there, now from
spring of 22, they had an agreement, and Boris Johnson, on behalf of the West, came in and said, "Don't do it. We'll back you in war. We'll back you," unspoken was, "to the last Ukrainian."
So it had been penciled. Everybody agreed to it. And this is one more reason why Russia doesn't trust the West, because they've continually gone back on this, and they've continued the war, and they keep wanting to blame Russia as the one who is a perpetrator.
Also, one of their demands added from historically what were first articulated over a year and a half ago, they've added the protection of languages and religion. This is specifically about the discrimination I just described against Russian speakers and the Russian Eastern Orthodox Church. And so now one of the key demands, in addition to demarcating certain territory, and in addition to demilitarization and neutrality, and to denazification, which is essential before you can have any elections, they also have demand for protection of religions and language.
So So nobody refers to that, even though there wouldn't have been any more war after April of 2022, and that this war has been going on. So this is most definitely not a Ukraine-Russian war, but it's a war against the U.S. and NATO. NATO, they're the ones that are backing this whole thing, and just keeping it going enough, trying to wear down Russia, as General Lloyd Austin said.
And yeah, way back in late 2021, then Commanding General Milley said what nobody else wanted to hear him say, which was that now is the best time for Ukraine to negotiate and enter the war. Their position would never get better. It would get worse. And he was not welcome after that and was kind of shuffled off further down the ladder. And, of course, we escalated the war instead of taking advantage of what would have been the opportunity, one more opportunity lost, to call a halt to it.
So all this destruction, loss of life, and the blowing up of much of many areas of Ukraine could have been avoided.
And I want to bring it up to date a little more because Douglas MacGregor, a very knowledgeable former military man, said basically the U.S. is deep in a fabric of lies about Ukraine, and I feel the same way. So many efforts are needed just to counteract the most basic propagandistic points. But the fact is, despite denial and denial and denial, Ukraine is losing and losing badly. And we've been told for months and years Ukraine is winning or can win. Russia's losing, is being defeated. Russia's on its last legs. Putin is gravely ill, and so on. And these are all false. And recently, and I'm going to give you some specifics that indicate how dire the situation is, and this is from our own Army Secretary Driscoll, who was over in Geneva trying to talk to the Europeans and explain to them how bad the situation is, and you're going to have to give up some of your illusions about the war. And this is in NBC News just a couple days ago. Here's some of what he told them. Ukraine is facing defeat. The Europeans were told this flatly. Russia could fight on independently for a long time because of its resources and mobilization, and the U.S. arms and defense industry could not keep supplying Ukraine with weapons and air defense at the rate needed to protect Ukraine population and infrastructure. Once again, this is from the Army Secretary, reported just 2 days ago in NBC News. So it gives you a reminder of the truth that Ukraine has been defeated badly, so many lives lost needlessly, and now it's probably not going to last much longer, but you never know. It might drag on for months or even much longer than that, because the West has a deep-seated, long-standing commitment to this, not to Ukraine, no, not to Ukraine, but to fighting Russia. And I want to also, before we get to the next tape, because I want to make sure we have time for two things, I want to mention a couple of Ukrainian voices. One is a historian, Marta Havrishko, now in exile because she fears for her safety, and opposed to continuing the war. A great interview on a site called The Burning Archive, which is an Australian historian, Jeff Rich, and he's interviewing recently Marta Havrishko, and... yeah, I heard her again recently, and it was quite good. And then one statement that I want to read from another Ukrainian. This one is Julia Mendel, no ordinary citizen. She was the press secretary for Zelensky himself until recently, and now she is an anti-war voice, as you'll hear. This is from Julia Mendel, quite recent. Oh, and on a previous posting of hers, she said they should stop listening to Europe. Europe cannot help us. They just want more war. They don't even talk with Russia. They have no money to help us. In this recent statement of just a few days ago, she said, every subsequent deal for Ukraine will only be worse because we are losing. We are losing people, territory, and the economy. The EU, which, by the way, has paid Russia more than 311 billion euros for energy and gold goods since February 22, has no real strategy, no way to stop fueling Russian budget or support Ukraine enough to win, no direct dialogue with Moscow, and no meaningful leverage over either the Kremlin or Washington. Arguments that, quote, Russia has gained so little land, unquote, sound almost childish when you consider the human cost. We have lost more people in 3 years than some European nations have as the whole population. My country is bleeding out. Many who reflexively oppose every peace proposal believe they are defending Ukraine. With all respect, that is the clearest proof they have no idea what is actually happening on the front line and in the country right now. War is not a Hollywood movie. I will never abandon the values that God and democracy both placed at the very foundation of human existence. Human life is the highest good, and people, living, breathing people, are the ones who must be saved.
Yes. So I have another thing. I think I've got it sort of queued up. I might have to tweak it a bit. Of Larry Johnson, who's also a former CIA analyst, and talking about Zelensky Corner. This is from Monday. And then also Lawrence Wilkerson, who's a U.S. Army colonel, retired, and formerly second in command in the U.S. State Department under Colin Powell.
If that is actually the document they've come up with, and it sounds legit, it's dead. Russians aren't going to go along with that at all, period. It's done. Example. Hey, we're going to cap off the Ukrainian military at 600,000. Well, Russia and Ukraine reached an agreement tentatively in Istanbul back in March of 2022, at which... it was going to be like 85,000. So, and at the time, if you may not recall, but the ground force, the total size of active ground forces on Ukraine's side at the start of the special military operation was about 270,000. So why, in what delusional world does Witkoff and these guys that came up with this agreement think that Russia's going to go, oh, yeah, let's agree to triple the size of the Ukrainian military. I mean, that's assuming they could scrape together 600,000 people. That's a whole nother issue. I would say 50% of what is listed on those 28 points are non-starters from Russia's standpoint. Again, on the territory. Yeah, they're going to recognize Donetsk, Luhansk, and Crimea as Russian territory, but Russia's got to freeze in place in Kherson and Zaporizhia. Freeze in place. They're not going to do that. They're winning. They're moving forward. This thing's only going to end with an unconditional surrender by Ukraine. Russia is not going to settle for anything less. They'll try to keep the lines of communication open, but... just yesterday, Putin was with the frontline troops, and he told him, he said, "Look, carry on until we achieve our objectives." Well, one of the key objectives is demilitarization of Ukraine, and that will happen either because the West will finally say, "Okay, we give up, we're gonna pull the plug," and the United States, Trump can do this today. Pull the plug on support for Ukraine. Stop sending them the money that they are stealing. But no, we won't do that. So Russia's going to finish it militarily. They're going to kill as many Ukrainian soldiers as they need to. They're going to continue to destroy Western soldiers that are inside Ukraine fighting. And they're going to keep destroying NATO equipment. That's how it will end.
Colonel, the size of the Ukrainian military before the war started, it was, if I'm not mistaken, 700,000, 400 active, soldiers and prepared for war, and 300, reservists, if I'm not mistaken. And right now they're talking about 600,000, something similar to what Ukraine was before the war started, and even larger than many other European countries. And how is that possible, in your opinion?
Let me take a little bit different position than Larry just evinced.
And let me go back a little bit and start at the beginning of what I would say about it. And that beginning is Alaska. I was dead wrong about, not so wrong about Alaska, but wrong in the general concept of things. And I was very wrong about the call between Sergey Lavrov and Marco Rubio. And let me explain why I say that. Out of Alaska came a more fundamental understanding of some very key issues that had nothing to do with Ukraine, really, except that Ukraine is an obstacle to going to those issues, like the security architecture of Europe, like the nuclear situation, particularly with no treaties, like New START going out in February of 26, and so forth. More progress was made on those issues than was evinced by either side. Then my real mistake was to characterize the call between Lavrov and Rubio as being non-productive, and mainly because of Rubio's obstinance. Au contraire, I'm told, by fairly competent authority, they, including Sergey Lavrov himself, they actually agreed that they were not ready for Budapest. They were not ready for Budapest, not because the Russians weren't ready. They've been ready for some time. They have all the paraphernalia of working groups, experts, teams, and so forth to do what's necessary to do, particularly to tackle these more serious issues than Ukraine. It was us that weren't ready at all. And so that's what put the kibosh on Budapest the first time around. Now I'm told that cooler heads have prevailed in the administration. I asked the question, name me one. But nonetheless, maybe down in the bowels of the expertise that might still remain at defense and state and other interested parties, they have put together at least a beginning of working teams, the kind of teams you would have for a real effective summit. Teams that can work the details, teams that can take the generalities that come out of the big guys and gals and go to work on the details that will make the agreement work or not work. And that's where they're headed now. And they're headed there with this, you know, so-called plan that Witkoff has leaked or whatever, somebody leaked. And I don't discount the fact that some of the provisions the United States is putting forward are non-negotiable with Russia. But I also don't discount the fact that that's the way you do diplomacy. I'm not attributing that ability to this administration by any stretch of the imagination, but I have to think maybe down in the bowels some people have prevailed, and there is some method to their madness. So they're not going in thinking that 600,000 will be the deal. They're not going in thinking that Russia will give up this or that in terms of territory gain. They're not going in without the idea that these things, they think, will be used as ammunition to maybe extract a few things out of Russia that might even be extractable, given the situation now, and that won't be too embarrassing for Trump, because otherwise the deal would be extremely embarrassing for him. He steps in finally as the ultimate peacekeeper, and that is essentially what he is. There's no one else that can solve this really in a swift sort of fashion, if we can even use that term, given the length of its duration. But he's the only one who can settle it. And he's the only one who can tell the Europeans to go pound sand and mean it and make them go pound sand. So I don't have that negative view of what's coming about, but I don't have any hope really that we're going to walk out. I think Larry's absolutely right about that. But I'm willing to suspend my disbelief for a little while and hope that something positive comes out of it. I've lost all faith in Witkoff. He's a scoundrel. So that's not a good thing. I've lost faith in Rubio a long time ago. But as I said, Lavrov sort of dissipated my negativism about that phone call in his description of it. Now, he might have been putting a fine tune on it that wasn't necessarily there in order to move things forward, but he's not usually that kind of diplomat. So I'm a little bit better, a little more optimistic opinion, and I can't believe I'm saying that about anything Trump administration does.
Well, yeah, let me just add that it's not so much me being negative, but I thank Larry, Colonel Wilkerson, for sake of not confusing the listeners. Larry, are you talking about yourself? No. Once this is formally submitted to the Russians, I'm sure that Lavrov and the foreign ministry will say something. Well, we have received an interesting proposal from the United States. It's one that we're going to carefully consider. And then, you know, we'll talk about it. And the point is, out of those 28 things, man, there is a lot to talk about. And there's a lot in there that, you know, frankly reflects the continued U.S. delusion about Russia. Prime example is number 13. Number 13 on the list says, Russia will be reintegrated into the global economy. The lifting of sanctions will be discussed and agreed upon gradually and on an individual basis. The U.S. will conclude a long-term economic cooperation agreement aimed at mutual development. It goes through all these things that would be beneficial to the U.S. And Russia will be invited to return to the G8. Russia doesn't give two hot dams about getting invited to go back to the G8. Right now, BRICS, the BRICS members, they represent more of the global GDP, and they have a higher economic growth rate than all of the G7 combined. Why would Russia want to join a bunch of...
So that was there, Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst, along with Lawrence Wilkerson, U.S. Army colonel retired, speaking nominally with Nima. And so they got into a lot of different issues there.
Didn't even get to the one about... seizing, i.e. stealing $140 billion of Russian assets held in Belgium so that they can fund Ukraine war some more. This is the current European idea. But Europe is divided, just like the U.S. is actually divided internally in the military and the warring group. They're wrestling. Europe was described as, one thing I listened to recently, is wrestling between ideological stubbornness and economic exhaustion. Many of the leading economies and the politicians, France, Germany, Britain, are in deep trouble. And so they're kind of afraid of losing their position, afraid of losing U.S. Backing, and it's the end of a period. And Ukraine doesn't have much leverage, as was said a couple times in today's program.
The excuse me, the economic things which the U.S. has guided Europe into when they got rid of the Nord Stream 1 and 2, Dave and I are quite certain the U.S. was involved, at least partially, if not more, in this brought Russian gas to much cheaper than they're getting it now from the U.S., from all the fracking that is being done in the U.S. And this is having economic effects on Europe, Western Europe, and today, I mean, it was on the news that Prime Minister Starmer in Britain is really under attack for some budget things that he's trying to put through, which make no sense according to the opposition, but probably don't. But the same thing is going on in Germany and France. They're, the the people who have signed up for more war, they are their economies are having deep trouble, and there's a big revolt by people who are citizens of these countries, and likely all of them are going to be voted out.
And they've got some notion, so they say, of military Keynesian economics. In other words, they're going to rebuild their economic strength, which is currently on the ropes, you know, in recession. Going to rebuild it through militarizing, you know, which is extremely implausible. And even if they try to do it, it's a decade or decades-long project, you know, so it's not really responsive to the current situation. It's just trying to whip up ideological fervor and propaganda rather than a rational argument or any real strategy for how to get out of this.
It's, you know, it's unlikely, but they are becoming more blustery. And they're recently, this same New York Times article I've been reading, that it was in today's Star Tribune. In recent days, European officials expressed dismay at points in this peace plan that would constrain NATO and give Moscow power over European security. Well, this is something they started worrying about, but actually Russia has tried to rearrange it before they went into the Ukraine in February of 2022. In December of 2021, Lavrov presented a way of reorganizing the security of Europe, and this was summarily dismissed by Biden, and it's gone on from there. So it's not like they haven't been having these ideas that are dealing with European security. But of course, what Lavrov wants also something to be included is Russian security, something that, Dave, you've often talked about, that never seems to be something to consider by the West. Never considers something like this.
At least in the Cold War, we had the notion of détente, which is at least mutual respect. Doesn't mean mutual affection. It means mutual recognition of the threat of nuclear war. And now we have these madmen thinking, oh, we're the superpower and we can do whatever we want and we don't even have to abide by nuclear arms treaties anymore. So things have been going from bad to worse on the U.S. ability to uphold any agreements. And again, we did this in Ukraine after 2015. Instead of abiding by a peace agreement in Minsk, we rebuilt Ukraine for war, and we did it again in 22 in Istanbul, as we've been trying to explain. And the problem is, what will be necessary now for Russia to trust such an untrustworthy adversary as the United States?
So this whole thing started off with the demise of the Soviet Union. And in return for Gorbachev said, well, you can have the reuniting of Germany, East and West, but don't have NATO move one foot to the east. And that was the agreement. They wouldn't go one foot to the east. And yet, next came up for as president was Bill Clinton, and in his second term, they added three countries, Poland, Romania, and Czech Republic, and it's been one after another. Now there's 15 or 16 in NATO, and so what does it look like when they're encircling Russia? And what is it about Ukraine? What's so big a difference about that? Well, Ukraine juts quite a bit into the east into Russia. And if the NATO put missiles there, they're only 5 minutes from Moscow. Right now, the missiles that the U.S. has put into Poland and Romania are 9 minutes away. Now, when they put these missiles in there, what did NATO say these missiles were for? Not against Russia. They were against missiles coming from Iran, thousands of miles away. Well, anybody could see through that, including the Russians. And one of the things about these missiles is that they can be part of a first strike event against Russia. And there are those who are advocating for a first strike against Russia. And so what would happen if they did? Some missiles might make it through that. And so this would be the missiles in Poland and Romania could take down any kind of counter thing to, I mean, it would still be shocking to the world, maybe a death knell to the world. But this has all got to be changed. We got to change how this whole omnipower idea that the United States had from the 1990s, when Russia was on its back and the capitalists from around the world were picking it clean. And so now it's we got to have a multipolar world.
Even as early as 1994, when Boris Yeltsin was Russian president and notoriously weak, he had a fierce argument at Munich Security Conference against the strategy of bringing Ukraine into NATO because he knew it would lead to civil war and the destruction of his country. And others warned against this. John Mearsheimer, Stephen Cohen, prominent historians and academics, and in a famous email leaked, thank you, WikiLeaks, William Burns, who was then ambassador to Russia, now head of CIA, and you can look this up online, a famous leaked email warning against this strategy, which was announced in 2008 by Bush, despite strenuous oppositions from Germany and other European countries. The plan was to get the countries of Georgia and Ukraine into NATO, and this is where we've seen wars and more wars. And so the famous email that from William Burns to Condoleezza Rice, no less, warned against the strategy of getting Ukraine into NATO. He said it would lead to civil war and Russian intervention and the destruction of Ukraine. And I'm here to repeat that that was what our planners wanted. It's not about Ukraine. It's about the war, long-term war, on trying to weaken Russia and break up Russia.
And they wanted to break up Russia and have greater access to all the resources of Russia and that whole Asian area there that hold a lot of mineral wealth and other wealth that the U.S. and the West wants.
Number one commodity producer in the world, grains, minerals, precious gems, different things. It's been a target on the part of the Brits for a couple hundred years, and on our part, I would say over 100 years since the Bolshevik Revolution.
Yes, back when the time when the sun never set on the British Empire, they had a war in the Crimea.
Yeah, the Black Sea had been critical for a long time, and it still is. Speaking of pipelines, the Turk Stream, which is the sole remaining Russian gas pipeline going through Turkey to feed Europe. Okay, Europe still really, really needs lots of gas, and the U.S. LNG supply is never going to be adequate. And Russia said it has detected several or numerous multiple attempts to damage the Turk Stream pipeline as well. So strategy is cut off Europe from dependence on Russia, which was a natural economic relationship, which was quite beneficial until they started blowing up the pipelines. And they're trying to worsen that situation and induce dependence on U.S. LNG. But from my reading, there's never going to be enough of that. So Europe is going down.
Yes, that's Germany used to be a export-orientated. It was a dynamo that they were doing. And they're lesser and lesser being able to have an economy that is very effective. And it's...
the struggle right now, just to summarize, because we're about done here, as expressed by John Helmer, an excellent correspondent, Dances with Bears is the name of his site. Spent a lot of time in Moscow, so he's very well informed. And his first book, by the way, was on Ukraine 2014 to 2018, about the billions of corruption that were siphoned away after the 2014 coup. Anyway, John Helmer had a good statement at describing the present situation as a U.S. struggle over how to continue the long war on Russia. That strategy hasn't changed. It's a question of how to pursue that strategy.
Now, this has been a long-term project, Republican and Democrat, especially Democrats. Trump has wanted to say recently that, this Ukraine war would never have happened if he had been president. It's possible. It's hard to know. He's so mercurial and across the board and does all these things.
He's an impulsive narcissist who thinks he can change things in a week or two. Like, remember how he's going to settle the war in 24 hours and all kinds of nonsense?
The first day on the job as president, he was going to... But it's... there are these things bigger than that. And how he keeps coming up with many of these other changes. So it's hard to know, but it has to be done with people knowing more. And if you only get your media from the mainstream public and corporate, I don't know about Fox News. I don't ever listen to that, or Newsmax, but what they say, but others there. But Dave, you have some sites that you find interesting.
Tucker Carlson, ex of Fox, formerly with Fox, has had some great interviews, both with Putin and with Western leaders. That, I think, is important and a good thing. You know, we just need more understanding on all sides. Yeah, I like the Glenn Deason site. Great interviews from a Norwegian professor. I've recommended repeatedly at the end of my Southside Pride columns different sites. There's Neutrality Studies with Pascal Lataz, who's in Japan. Another professor, he's actually Austrian. One more historical bit. Speaking of Austria, remember there was a very difficult situation in Austria, which resulted in a 1955 agreement with multiple opposing parties approving neutrality. Yeah, neutrality, which is something we haven't been able to tolerate, we the United States war planners. But we had a neutral Finland, we had a neutral Austria, we had a neutral Sweden, we had a neutral Switzerland, we had a neutral Ukraine. And we need to get back to those things.
The Glenn Deason, how do you spell that last name?
D-I-E-S-E-N. Glenn Deason has really great interviews with people around the world. And similarly, Pascal Lataz on neutrality studies, and also Nima Al-Khashid, who's an Iranian now based in Brazil. And Dialogue Works is the name of his site. And these are all good places to find experienced former diplomats, former military, former intelligence scholars, and the like, who give you perspectives you're not going to get in the U.S. mainstream.
Yes, and much even of the alternative press, they've been pro the U.S. position on the war. It's been a very divisive thing, what's going on here. Many of the magazines I distribute, they're essentially pro-war.
Check out Max Blumenthal on The Gray Zone also. He's very good.
Yes, Max Blumenthal was very early on having things on. What was going on? I met a good number of years ago in Gaza. I mean, he's gone over there often. That he's written a book on a lot of the power things for the U.S. And so it's the gray zone has a lot of very good things, especially Max Blumenthal.